Like this show and want to make your own? Let me tell you about Anchor. It's free, and they have creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And now you can even add any song from Spotify directly to your episodes. The possibilities are endless for what you can create, whether it's music analysis, your own radio show, or something the world's never heard before. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. And you can also make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
Hi, and welcome to the Vocal Fries podcast, the podcast about linguistic discrimination.
I'm Carrie Gillen.
And I'm Megan Figueroa. And we have a sexiest accent problem again.
That makes it sound like we've talked about it before, but I don't think we have. Well, but it's true that it comes up a lot.
The world has a sexiest accent problem again. So I feel like it comes up every, I don't know, maybe it's like traveling season or something, because it always seems to be like these travel blogs or like, it seems to be people that are like, here are places to visit and let's, I don't know, sexy accents kind of thing. Because this latest one seems to be like from a travel. So big7travel.com has the top 50 sexiest accents in the USA ranked.
Yes. And the ranking is interesting. It's not exactly what I was expecting. Because 1.5 million people apparently took part in this study, which is not a very well-designed study, but, no. You know, whatever. The poll. This one. Right. So it's a lot of people involved, and it does tell you something about how people think of dialects.
No, absolutely. The fact that they can keep reusing this idea, like, what's the sexiest accent, and still get clicks, tells you a lot about people and how they think about.
We clicked on it.
I mean, I just like to be angry, Carrie.
Me too. Well, I did post one of the versions to our Facebook page because it was about how Baltimore was one of the sexiest accents, and then it turned out it was number 18, which I thought was hilarious that, you know, they were like crowing about being number 18.
Right.
But also, like, what?
Sure. I think it must be because like they never get any love for their accent. It's usually like disparagingly talked about, right?
Is it talked about at all? I don't even have like a perception of what Americans think of Baltimore accent.
Huh. I mean, maybe I'm lumping it in with like everything else, like New Jersey or New York or something.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it's closer to Washington, D.C., I think. Hmm. I don't know if it has the same accent as Washington, D.C., but just, right. Like, I don't really have any, like, conception of it at all. Like, when I think of Baltimore, I think of the corrupt police system.
Oh,
there.
Sure. Definitely.
It is outrageous.
Yeah, it's fucked.
Even within the milieu of the United States.
Right. Yeah, so I guess I'm not thinking about the way they talk, just how fucked up they are. Like, the police, right. I mean. Yeah.
So I don't even have any conception of them at all. So, like, how would I, let's say I thought this was a good idea to rank accents by sexiness. I wouldn't even know where to put them because I don't know how they talk. Even though I've heard them talk many times, I just don't have, like, a stereotype of it.
Right. I'm thinking of The Wire. I'm like, yep. No, that's not helping. not helping at all.
Some of them did definitely have Baltimorean accents.
It does nothing sticks out to me.
Right.
Also, what is sexy? You know, like, tell me what that is.
Yes. So I was going to ask that question, and then I was like, oh, there's a can of worms. I mean, it's so subjective, obviously.
Yeah.
But the fact that, like, there's some agreement, sort of.
Yeah.
Means there's some kind of ideology underpinning it all.
Right. And so, general American, 32nd.
Yeehaw!
I know, right?
And that reminds me, Texan is number one, which actually surprised me because of that, you know, the idea there's an ideology underpinning all of this. I would never have predicted that Texan would be number one.
Yeah, no, I definitely, I mean, no. I don't even know what to say about that. And okay, I just obviously have to say 12th Chicano. Like, what is happening? It's like, y'all aren't, like, I'm seeing a lot of racism in other places when we're talking about Chicanos, but all of a sudden 12th and sexiest accents? What?
Yeah, I was surprised by that as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, I mean, I wasn't surprised to see that, like, California Valley was, like, in the 40s. Yeah, so I'm just like, okay, wait, Texan, Bostonian, and New York are the top three, and that's not, like, at all.
What do they share in common? Almost nothing.
You know what they do share in common, I think? We all have some sort of idea of what they sound like.
Oh, that's true. I do have a much better sense of those three, even though, even within Texas, there's like a bunch, and within New York, there's a bunch. But still, like, stereotypically, I have accents in my head for all three places. That's true.
Yep. Yeah. That's the only thing that I can think of, and it's just like, none of this makes sense. None of it, like, you can't, you ask people that, I don't know, like, we're going off of media, like 1.5 million people. I bet most of them haven't traveled to all, you know, these places. It's going to be like media.
Of course. Yeah.
And so I don't know. I mean, this is all wrong anyway. We should never
never rank accents in any way, shape or form. But sexiness in particular just makes me laugh because like, what?
It should be like the 50th sexiest accents ranked, and all of them are number one.
Yes. Like... Interesting. Another interesting thing was that the New Jersey accent was placed pretty low.
49th,
almost dead last. Mm-hmm. And yet New York accent was much, much, much higher. Yep. And at least North Jersey and New York share an accent. Yeah, so it's people don't know. That's what it comes down to. People really don't know what accents really are, where the boundaries are,
and even if you're not being like overtly discriminatory, there are discriminatory things that are underlying these instincts to say what is sexy or not. And I guess we really just want to get to the point where, you know, most people see something like this and they're like, oh, no, this isn't okay. You know, like, I don't know when that's going to happen. Of course, our listeners are already there, but I mean, I don't know.
I don't know either. But it does really show that people have a different conception of what it means to be from New York versus what it means to be from New Jersey, even though culturally they're very similar.
Well, in Long Island.
And then Long Island has 50. Its own.
Yeah. Yeah,
they've way, separated. Way, way lower than the rest of New York.
Yeah, yeah.
The article that Luke Capella sent to us.
Our Jerseyan
former guest. That article says something like, all this being said, most people can't hear their own accents. Ah, ding, 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 ding. And it turns out we're not very good listening to ourselves. So, yeah, that's part of it.
Yes. Yes. Okay, well, at least, some people are having good conversations around this. So this is just a terrible list anyway, like how they've demarcated these things. So, I mean, it certainly wasn't a linguist who did it, because a linguist should always say, no, no, I will not help you with that. You shouldn't do it.
The only way you would do this is to try and figure out some ideology.
Oh, yeah, that would be really cool.
Because, I mean, this is telling us some of the underlying ideology. It's just not telling us in a very clear, transparent way, but it's giving us some hints.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
That's the only reason why this is interesting.
All of a sudden, I love it. I love it. Let's do it. But yeah.
I don't want to do that. That's not...
No. This is a huge project.
Like, people who have done this kind of thing before,
do
have
it.
At it.
Yeah. Yeah. Look at this list and see how people have separated. It makes no sense, some of them. So...
Totally unrelatedly. Last week, Chris and I went to this Patreon meetup. They came to Phoenix because they were also going to Arcosanti. And if any people don't know what Arcosanti is, it's an interesting art space that you can look up. But anyway, so they were coming here for a concert, and they decided to host a meetup. So we went, and it was really fun and interesting, and yeah, lots of good tips.
Enlightening.
It was enlightening. And so just want to remind everybody that we have a Patreon, patreon.com/vocalfriespod.
Yes. Sorry, I just saw your cat and I was like, that she looks
she looks very
she looks
out.
Like a puddle of cat.
Just... She looks like a puddle of cat.
Anyway. Yes, thank you so much for your support on Patreon. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, we do.
We're fueled by love.
And fueled Patreon. By love. Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Today is the first time we talk about Creole languages.
Mm-hmm. Well, officially, one Creole language.
Officially. Yes, one Creole language. So that's exciting.
It's very cool. It's very cool.
Yes, yeah. We would happily talk about more. Just hit us up.
Yes, I want to talk about all the Creoles.
Yeah, let's do it.
And all other languages as well.
Yes. So excited to have Keisha Wheel with us today. She is a PhD student of anthropology at Temple University. Her research interests include Creole languages of the Caribbean and their place in education. She is particularly interested in Papiamentu and the dichotomy between its use in cultural settings and formal educational settings. Thanks for coming on the show and talking to us.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Of course.
Really excited. We haven't talked to anyone about any Caribbean languages yet. So this is exciting.
No. Or Creole languages.
Yeah. We've mentioned it on the show, but haven't really got into it. So could you just start off by telling us, what is a Creole language?
Okay, so that's actually sort of a contested term depending on who you speak to. But in its most basic sense, a Creole language is a language that's sort of developed through an advent of something like colonialism. It doesn't necessarily have to be colonialism, but that's where most of our Creole languages, where we see that they sort of come from. And basically it's sort of when all these one or more groups sort of get together and they need a way to communicate. And there's sort of been this kind of there's been this debate for the longest about whether Creoles evolved from pigeons or whether they're sort of separate from pigeons, where you've had sort of this old school saying of like, well, Creoles developed from pigeons because pigeons were sort of these languages that were created in order for everybody to communicate together. And then Creoles were what was born from that. As soon as the first speaker of that pigeon came to be, this is what Creoles are. And now we're starting to see that that might not necessarily be the case. You have people who are saying that pigeons are something completely different than Creole languages. And I'm a linguistic anthropologist, so a linguist would have a far better explanation than I would exactly about the intricacies between pigeons and Creoles. But at its most basic sense, Creoles are just sort of these languages that were created because of sort of some type of like language contact.
And where did your interest in Creole languages, and I'm going to pronounce this word differently than Megan does, Caribbean, come from?
Oh, well, it's actually pretty interesting. So my mom is from Aruba and my father is from Curacao. And I remember as a kid, you know, I grew up speaking Papiamentu, but I was always told that it wasn't a real language, which is the case with most, especially first generation students from the Caribbean who live in the United States. We're always told that whatever our parents speak is not a real language. It's sort of some sort of bad, you know, French or English or Spanish or whatever. The difference with Papiamentu, on the other hand, is that Papiamentu has such a mixture within its languages. It's never considered sort of a bad form of Spanish or a bad form of Portuguese. So they just, you know, the way it was told to me was just, it was just this language that nobody really, like, people speak it, but it's not a real language like English or Dutch or Spanish. So, you know, when I was, I remember asking my aunt one day to ask her how to write something in Papiamentu, and she was just like, oh, you just write it however you feel because it's, you know, it's not a real language. And it kind of stuck with me because I was like, well, if it's not a real language and if I speak it, everybody understands what I'm saying. So I don't understand why it's not a real language. But, you know, I was like a teenager at the time, so I put it out of my mind. And it wasn't until I actually got to my freshman year of undergrad at the University of North Florida, and Dr. Ronald Kephart, I don't know if you guys know him or not, I was speaking to him, and he does work on Creole languages, and he was just like, wait a minute, so you speak Papiamento? And I was like, yeah, you know, I speak that language, whatever, it's not a real thing. And he's just like, wow, I can't believe you speak this language. And, you know, so he was really just sort of pushing this, like, wow, you know, you speak this Creole language, and it's so interesting. And I was just taken aback that this was the first time ever, you know, that I heard about this, and not from someone from my island, but a white man, you know, from the U.S. is telling me this. You know, he's from, I think, Virginia or Maryland. I don't remember specifically what state. You know, here's this guy telling me how great my language is compared to my own family and my own, you know, people around me who've never told me about that. So through him, I really started looking into what Creole languages were, and I took a lot of classes with him, and that's how I got interested in it.
When you go back, do you say, listen, this is what happened when I went to university. We should respect our language. Do you do that now? And do you, like, kind of tell everyone we have this really special thing?
It depends on who I speak to. So thankfully right now, I mean, these people, you do have some scholars on the island who've been advocating for it for decades. I just recently met them within the past 10, 15 years. But the shift on how people are viewing their language is changing now than it was, let's say, even 15, 20 years ago. And I have to give a lot of credit to those on the island who've been doing the work for decades. You know, they've really been sort of pushing even against political dissent, even against personal, you know, they've been the ones who have pushing. And not to say that it's completely like, oh, everybody's like, yes, Papiamento is our language, and, you know, but I give credit to them mostly. I mean, I do as well. Like, if I do tend to talk to people from time to time now, especially, you know, when I'm doing sort of my preliminary research and I'm talking to them about language and education, you do have a lot of people like, oh, well, you know, and I guess we'll talk about this a little bit more later. And they'll say, oh, well, yeah, you know, Papiamento is great as our language and it's our cultural identity, but you're never going to get anywhere with that because it's not a full-fledged language compared to Dutch and English. So now it's sort of shifted from it being not a language at all to not a full-fledged language in a way that you can go somewhere with it. So they're valorizing it as like, oh, this is this great cultural part of our identity. But then at the same time, it's like, okay, but it's not a full language like, you know, these other European languages that we can actually progress in.
Right. Baby steps, I guess.
Right. Very baby steps. But, you know, like I said, the work is being done. And I am glad that it is shifting. Let's put it like that. I really am glad that the tone and ideas about language on this island, on both islands, are shifting.
Yeah, that's great. So can you tell us something about Papiamento? Like, I know only a very little amount, and I imagine that some of our listeners know nothing. So what makes it unique, or what properties that it have that are interesting?
Okay. What to say about Papiamento? So I would say, compared to other Creole languages in the Caribbean, Papiamento is the only Creole language in the Caribbean that doesn't have sort of a direct lexical link to the colonizer that is on these islands. So, like, you know, Aruba and Curaçao Bonaire, they were colonized, and Aruba and Curaçao Bonaire are the only three islands in the whole world that's where they speak Papiamento. And they were colonized by the Dutch, like the last colonizer, because, you know, with the Caribbean, everybody was colonized by all these different countries. And finally, the Dutch were the last ones to colonize us. But what was interesting about the Dutch was that the Dutch weren't really interested in promoting their language like the French were, or promoting anything about them, their religion, their language, or anything, their culture. They were just like, listen, we're here to traffic in the slave trade. We're here to do merchant stuff. Like, we're not here to put our culture to these other people. And so because of that, Papiamento, which there are a lot of different theories, like Genesis theories on how it's created, but the most, I guess, prevalent one is the Afro-Portuguese Creole genesis theory, that there was this Afro-Portuguese Creole that came from West Africa and sort of came to the different Caribbean islands. But because we were never relexified, I guess you can say, by the Dutch, that language stayed. And it's not to say that there aren't any other Dutch Creoles in the Caribbean. There were a couple, but they all died out. But with, in terms of Aruba, Curaçao, and Bonaire, we never shifted into a Dutch Creole. It just stayed as sort of this Afro-Portuguese Creole with Spanish influences. There's a little bit of Dutch influences, obviously, as well as French, very little French and English. And one of the interesting things as well is that there's sort of a bottom-up approach. So compared to other Caribbean Creole languages, our Creole is one of, or maybe the only Caribbean Creole language that's actually spoken at all levels of societies in terms of class. There's no class restriction or no race restriction. So we wouldn't say like Dutch white descendants or descendants of Jews, like they don't speak Papiamento, no, because that's considered the language of the slaves. Like they also speak that as well. And in terms of class as well, there is no class distinction, with the exception of like you might have a Papiamento that, like they would say, is más nachu, which means it's nicer, the nicer Papiamento, versus the más bruto, which is like the rougher Papiamento. But it's still the fact that that Creole language is at all levels of society. And we are one of only two Caribbean Creoles that actually has an official status. So Haitian Creole is the other one. And then in Aruba and Curaçao, Papiamento has an official status alongside Dutch on the islands. And Bonaire used to have it too, but politically, because Bonaire became an overseas territory of the Netherlands after the dissolution of the Netherlands Antilles, it went back to just being a recognized language. So there's a lot of historical stuff to it, and I'm trying to like condense it into like, you know, 2 minute sound bites, but it is sort of like this long, sort of very interesting history, because we really, you know, as terms of Creole languages go, we have this dichotomy of being valorized as having all of these attributes, like having official status compared to like Jamaican patois that doesn't, you know. But at the same time, we still have these sort of negative ideas about what we can do with the language or where we can go with the language.
And so growing up, what are the languages that someone on Aruba is going to learn?
Ooh, okay. So people in Aruba and Curaçao, on average, speak about 4 languages. And to varying degrees of fluency. Those 4 main ones are Papiamento, Dutch, English, and Spanish. So Papiamento, most people on the island, they grew up hearing it. That's just something that's in their home. Dutch, they get introduced to at school because that is the language of education still for the most part. Spanish, I remember when I was asking some college students, well, how did you learn Spanish? Most of them are like, oh, well, you know, my grandmother, the lady who cleans our house, she watches novelas a lot from Venevisión or Univision. So I just learned Spanish from that. So a lot of people, like, they pick up Spanish from, you know, and we have a very close proximity to Venezuela and Colombia as well. So it's sort of like that cultural influence has seeped in. And that's where a lot of people learn Spanish from, as well as like reggaeton and all of that. And English, a lot of it is from television as well. Like, I know when speaking to a lot of the kids now, especially because I would say the youth today compared to like previous generations, their English is on a level that I've never seen. And a lot of them just attribute it to, or at least the ones that I spoke to, they're just like, yeah, I just watched a lot of Discovery Kids and Disney Channel when I was a kid. And you know, their English has developed to a point that when they speak English, you know, they don't speak it with an accent. It's more of like an Americanized accent, which is very interesting. And they learn just sort of a lot of nuances of American English that, let's say, like their parents wouldn't necessarily know or be hip to. And that's not including, you know, other people or people on the islands who have, like, let's say, first generation or second or even third generation Portuguese immigrants or Haitian immigrants or, let's say, Chinese immigrants from India, like they also bring all their languages as well. So like I said, the four main ones is what most people can speak. And then you have also others as well, where based on their background that they might speak those languages too.
And did you go through the educational system on the islands?
No. So I grew up in New York City. And I didn't go to school for 1 month in Curacao because New York City, we started school in September, and in Curacao, they start in August. And I would always happen to be in Curacao during the month of August. And my sister and I, you know, we really wanted to enjoy our summers. And my aunt was just like, that's not happening. You guys are going to school, because my other aunt was a teacher there and the principal was the best friend of my dad. So they were just like, we're going to put you in school there. So for about a month up until sixth grade or so, we would get education within the system, which was completely in Dutch. Which is a very interesting thing for us because, you know, my sister and I, we didn't grow up speaking Dutch. We grew up speaking Papiamentu. So, Papiamentu in English. So, like, to get this education in Dutch was just, like, a mind, like, our minds being blown in that essence. Because after that month ended, we would just go back to the American system right. Anyway. So, but I have to say, though, if I have time... the one thing that I found really interested in and that really sort of sparked initially my interest in language and education was I remember clearly in second grade is when we first started going to school. We had a teacher who did not speak Papiamentu at all, which was the case back then, was that you would have a lot of teachers who didn't speak Papiamentu at all. All they spoke was Dutch, and sort of the kids there, they would kind of have to forced to learn Dutch, and if not, then oh well, you know. And I remember this teacher, very nice teacher, but also very strict. She would speak Dutch only. And I remember the kids in our class, mind you, this is second grade, so how old are we, 7 or 8? You know, a lot of the students at that time didn't speak Dutch because their introduction to Dutch is, you know, their first, second grade. If they had problems understanding, she would just be like, no, like, you're supposed to know. And, you know, she's telling them in Dutch, like, they're supposed to know this already. This is not her problem. But then with my sister and I, because we were, I guess, American for this, she would switch to English. Mm. And she would help us a lot and be like, okay, yeah, this word is in English, but this is what it is in Dutch and blah, blah, blah. And then, like, if a friend of ours or whoever had an issue, because they spoke Papiamentu, then it was just like, no, like, you're supposed to know this by now.
Wow, you're already getting that messaging. There's a hierarchy of languages.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Very early on. I don't know if that necessarily happens now, because I haven't been inside of a classroom, obviously, in decades. But that was something that I constantly remembered clearly, that was just really sort of distinct. And even back then, when I didn't have sort of the know-how or the knowledge to articulate my feelings about it, it always felt wrong in a way. Like, yeah, you're helping us because we speak English and we're American for these purposes, but the kids who you're going to teach for the whole entire year, you know, they're not understanding, and it's up to them to understand as opposed to you, the teacher, to help them understand.
Have you looked into stats in the educational system on the islands? I just kind of wonder, do the teachers tend to be also speakers of four languages, or are they mostly just like Dutch and English? Or
yeah, a lot of the teachers now are from the islands themselves. Like they went to Europe or the US to study and then come back, and they would go to like the teachers' college here. So most of them do speak the four languages. As opposed to back in the day, like my parents' generation, the majority of teachers were actually nuns and brothers from the Netherlands or from Suriname. So, you know, with them, I mean, my parents' generation, if they were even caught speaking Papiamentu on the playground, they would get severely reprimanded, like beat or be made to write on the board in Dutch, I will not speak that language. My generation, it was sort of shifting by that point that you started having a lot of teachers from the islands who were coming. And now, from what I've been told, you do have a lot of teachers from the island, but even though they do speak Dutch, their Dutch is not at a level that's considered appropriate, let's say. So they can speak Dutch with fluency, but it's not at a, what, from what I've been told, it's not at a level that allows the student to actually learn something in that language. So a lot of, and I've spoke to some students who are in college where they were telling me, like, you know, most of us, we're getting taught in Papiamento at the elementary school level, but we have to, like, switch to Dutch once we get to secondary school. So they kind of start forcing Dutch onto us in the elementary school as a way to prepare us, but they're not doing it in a way that, like, is conducive to us actually learning the language. So most of them have to do what they call bayles, or tutoring. So most kids have to take tutoring in Dutch in order to be prepared for secondary education. So, and then they were telling me once they get to tertiary, once they get to university level, either if it's in the Netherlands or if it's on the island itself, most of their studies are in English with some, like, let's say, law, things like that, that remains in Dutch. But if you're doing, like, marketing or business or anything like that, that tends to be in English. So then they're getting sort of, at every stage, they're getting a different language. And it's interesting now that you do have teachers from the islands who are sort of like trying to figure out a way to make this work. You know, I don't place the blame on the teachers at all. I think it's just a system that's sort of weird. But they're trying to figure out a way to teach Dutch in a way that's working for them or working for their students, and then at the same time not lose Papiamento in a way. But I also think some of the materials that they have, like I've seen one or two materials that they have in for teaching Dutch here, and the problem is they teach Dutch as if Dutch is their mother tongue. So, you know, I remember I think maybe 2 years ago I started taking some Dutch language classes. And the teacher was teaching me via English, and she's just like, oh my God, you're so much better than all these kids that I teach here. And I was like, oh, why is that? And she's just like, I don't know. And I'm looking at the booklet that she's giving me, and the booklet is completely in Dutch. There's no translation from Papiamento whatsoever. And she is translating from English to Dutch for me. So, of course, I'm picking it up. And also, you know, Dutch and English are a lot more closely connected than Papiamento and Dutch is. So I'm picking it up with a level of fluency that, you know, it's because of my proximity to Germanic languages and all these other things that, you know, a lot of these kids don't get, especially at a very young age. So that was something that, you know, really made me want to see, like, or at least I hope with my research, my dissertation research at the end, like what can be done to help this out, not necessarily eradicate Dutch, because I don't think anybody wants to eradicate Dutch from the school system, but definitely shift it in a way that allows these kids to learn it in a way that prepares them, as opposed to saying, well, no, this is sort of the language that you have to learn and you're going to learn it as if it's your mother tongue.
Kind of reminds me of a conversation we had, which was coming out on Monday, but it'll be a while in the past for this episode, that we had with Nicole Horserter about Dene Bazad or Navajo. And there's one dual language at a school, which is not even on the reservation. It's in a neighboring town, Flagstaff, and just like how difficult it is to prepare kids for English, but also still, you know, keep Dene alive,
right,
and keep them speaking that language. So
yeah, and at this point it's really just a vestige of the past having Dutch as the official language in the school system, right? I mean, right. In a way, would you say that's true, or is it Dutch is still used at like the courts and all of these things?
Yeah, Dutch, to be honest, is not used that much on the islands at all, because even at the courts and let's say in government meetings, they use Papiamento now, which back in the day they used to use Dutch, but they use Papiamento now. In court proceedings, they use mostly Papiamento. If there is a judge who is from the Netherlands who speaks Dutch, you can request a translator. So aside from that, They're really, not to say there's no use for Dutch whatsoever, but it's very, very minimal on the islands. And English, on the other hand, because tourism is our main number one, and especially more so with Aruba than Curacao, English has become the language that it's like, okay, well, if you really want to get far on this island, because our main economic source is tourism, English is the way to go. Because, you know, in Aruba, it's mostly American tourists that are coming. And in Curacao, they're starting to get a lot more American tourists. And even if it's not American tourists, a lot of tourists are just speaking English. So it's this idea of like, well, and I've heard this from a lot of parents too, when I was talking to them in terms of like what languages should be used in education. It was interesting that a lot of parents were like, you know, I mean, I wouldn't mind Papimento being in there, but if we have to choose between Dutch or English, I would say English, because English is going to get my kid farther than Dutch at this point.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Do you think that was that feeling was already happening when you were doing that month each year in school? Because like for that teacher to switch to English, I wonder if like English was at the top of the hierarchy already. Kind of like English, Dutch.
I wouldn't say that it was English, Dutch. Especially in Curacao at that time, Dutch was still very much... Curacao has a very complex relationship with the Netherlands, and it's a lot closer than Aruba is, per se. And where I had went to school was in Curacao, so Dutch was still sort of like top hierarchy, that Dutch was prestigious, Dutch was going to get you far, and then English. You know, English was just like, okay, yeah, that's going to work in the tourism sector, so you should really know English. But yeah, I think now... it's weird because I would put them at the same level when it comes to competing for jobs, but it's at the same time, I think there's just very different ideas of how people see Dutch and very different ideas of how people see English and even Spanish. So with Dutch is like, it's the colonial language, and you'll hear a lot of people basically talk kind of bad about like how Dutch was this and how Dutch was sort of detrimental for them, but then at the same time it's like, well, we can get so much farther than with Dutch. So it's very, I remember one linguist on the island, she said we have a very schizophrenic mindset when it comes to Dutch. So we hate it, but then we love it at the same time. And then English, on the other hand, it was just like, yeah, English is going to get us far because that's sort of the globalizing language. Like, we're going to go everywhere with English. Everybody speaks English. And then Spanish, because we're in such close proximity to South America and to also our surrounding areas, Spanish has a very interesting relationship on these islands, because Spanish is mostly the language of like domestic workers here. We had a lot of Spanish immigrants who came here who come to like, let's say, work as people who clean houses or the hotels or anything like that. But because we still have that relationship with Venezuela and with Colombia and even the Dominican Republic and all these places, it's still venerated as like, oh, that's an extra language that we know. And also because our cultures are similar in a sense, it's sort of like, it's same. I would say it's sort of that same kind of schizophrenic mindset. So it's like, yeah, look at how well I can speak Spanish, because Spanish is like, we're close to South America and we can converse with people there and do business there. But at the same time, let's say if someone who's habla español here, someone from Venezuela who's taking my order, for example, you'll have a lot of people who would just not refuse to speak Spanish and speak Papimento with them, because they're like, you're on our island, you're working here, you should know Papimento. Like, I don't go to Venezuela and speak Papimento, I have to speak Spanish. You know, so it's like, yeah, I know how to speak Spanish, but because you're on my island, you have to know. So it's really, you know, and a lot of it, I think, as well, has to do with what's been going on with Venezuela as well lately, you know, with the political unrest. I mean, starting with Chavez, there's sort of been, if we have seen an influx of a lot of Venezuelan immigrants coming to the islands. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, there has been a rise of like xenophobic ideas about Venezuelan immigrants and about Spanish speakers, where it's just like, if you're a certain type of Spanish speaker, like, let's say upper class or from a certain Spanish speaking place, you're fine. you know, you'll have people who will speak Spanish to you, especially if it's in a place of business or things like that. But if it's, you know, the lady who cleans your room, for example, then it's on some other level of like, well, no. And I'm not saying this is about everybody. I think there is a discussion that's happening now on the island, especially because of what's happening in the United States. I think a lot of people are looking at our own islands like, wait a minute, we're sort of mirroring what's happening with, like, you know, racist Trump supporters. So maybe we need to take a step back and realize that we're also being xenophobic in these instances as well. So I think, thankfully, there is sort of like this discussion that's sort of being had. I think the discussion needs to go further, in my personal opinion, but there is sort of like this thing of like, okay, we need to figure out what we're doing with this, because, you know, immigrants from Venezuela, especially now, especially what happened with Guaido coming in, like, they're not going to stop coming in, you know, and we have to deal with it in a way that doesn't seem racist or xenophobic.
I kind of want to switch back to Pepe and Mintu a little bit. So why is it important to you that it's spoken by people on the islands?
It's because I grew up with the language, and like other Creole languages, I think it has its place. And also, I think for far too long, like other Creole languages, it's been considered a non-language, where people, on the other hand, have been able to do so much through that language. I mean, there's poetry, there's things written through the language, and it's the way that people communicate. And just because it's a younger language compared to other European languages doesn't necessarily mean that it doesn't deserve its place within the canon of languages. And that's why I'm going to go back to what I was saying about the term Creole languages. I remember I took a class with Michel DeGraff at the Linguistic Summer Institute a couple of years ago. And he and also Salikoko Mufweni, they were talking about this idea of like categorizing Creole languages as Creoles because, you know, they're sort of considered their own special language. And even though that happens, we inadvertently separate them from quote-unquote normal languages, that, oh, it's because they're Creole languages, not just regular languages, but Creole languages. And I think, in a way, people on the islands have internalized that negatively or positively, in a way to say that, yeah, we're not like English and we're not like Spanish, so we still have a lot of work to do and we still have, you know, all these other things. And I think the reality is, if we want to take Papiamento serious, as well as other Creole languages, but Papiamento in particular seriously, we need to start reflecting on how we view the language first. And that includes me. Like, I'm not going to lie, there are moments where I'm just like, Papiamento is so special. It does this, 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 you know, and I'm not even a full linguist, but I'm just like, yeah, it's this great, you know, and it's just like, well, yeah, but so does other languages, so does English, so does French, so does, you know, so it's sort of just like saying, well, yeah, it's a normal language like every other language, and it deserves its place, because the reality is, you know, like I said, when it comes to education, you know, kids being taught in their own language really helps them succeed, you know, in a way that being taught in a foreign language, and let's be clear here, I'm going to say it on a podcast, Dutch is a foreign language on this island. It's not a first or second language. English and Spanish are, you know. Dutch is a foreign language. Unless your family is from Suriname or from the Netherlands, you hardly hear Dutch outside of school. Like, you hardly do. And the problem is that if kids are taught in a foreign language that they don't understand, there's a whole doesn't matter how smart they are, there's a whole host of problems that's going to come with that. And especially if everything rides on that. So, like, for example, the exams that they have to take to get into secondary school. So the way that the education system is set up here, it's not just high school. There's, like, different levels of high school. So you have MAVO in Aruba, you have VSBO in Curacao, and then the two highest are HAVO and VWO. And with HAVO and VWO, those are the two that you can go straight to, like, university level, right? the majority of kids get tracked into the lower levels. So Mavo, VSBO. Reason, it's not the only reason, but it's speculated that one of the major reasons is their exams that suggest what level of high school that they should go into is completely in Dutch. So it doesn't matter how smart they are. You know, once they take that, exam, if their Dutch is not proficient, they're being tracked into, and I think the last statistics that I checked is around 60 something percent that get tracked into VSBO, that gets tracked into MAVO and Aruba, And it's not that it's bad, it's just that it takes them extra to get to that level. So if they want to go to research university, they have to go through the lowest level first in order to get to the higher level. And then that's an extra couple of years. And then finally, they can go to university. Like, for example, my niece, for example, she's currently in VSBO. And 2 years ago, I think it was 2 years ago, she was asking me for help with her homework. Mind you, I don't speak Dutch that well, but I was like, sure, I'll try my best. So she was like, yeah, we have to read this paragraph and make questions based on what we read. Simple. It's very simple. You know, and she was, I think, at the time, like 12, 13. So it's very simple. So I said, okay, read the paragraph to me. Tell me what you understand about this paragraph. And she looks at me like, I can't do that. I was like, okay, well, translate this paragraph into Papiamentu so that way you can understand. And then she looks at me again and she's like, well, I can't do that. And I'm like, what do you mean you can't do that? And I'm like, you can't translate this simple paragraph from the language that you're being taught into to the language that you currently speak. And she was like, no, I can't. So then what I had to do was I took out Google Translate. I translated the Dutch paragraph into English. And then from English, I translated it into Papiamentu for her. And that's when she understood what was in that paragraph. And she was able to make questions in Papiamentu that we would then translate into Dutch for her to have. And this was just one paragraph, one thing. And it took us, I think, like 2-3 hours. Obviously, she didn't even finish her homework for that day, you know, while I was there with her. But the fact that that little simple thing that maybe should take like 20 minutes took 2-3 hours. Because I sat down and I took the time with her to translate everything, you know, and that was something that really sort of stuck out to me because I'm like, she's not a dumb kid. I know she's not dumb. I know she can speak Dutch because I've heard her speak Dutch. But the fact that she couldn't comprehend her own homework says a lot. And I asked her, like, well, do you tell your teacher, you know, when you don't understand? And she's like, well, I do, but then we don't have time. So we always have to continue and go over. And I'm like, is everybody else like that in your school? And she's like, basically, yeah. Like, if we don't understand, we never have time to actually go over it. So we have to continue on.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
That is not good pedagogy.
So it's an issue. It really is an issue.
Yeah, and absolutely. Like you said, that is not a reflection at all of any individual child's intelligence.
No.
And that's really frustrating.
And it doesn't even take advantage of their full linguistic repertoire. I mean,
no,
we
yeah.
had in Aruba, they were doing a pilot study that they called Skol Multilingual. And it was basically some scholars on the islands, linguists as well as educators, who were like, listen, all of these kids speak 4 languages, and we're going to try this educational model that incorporates all 4 languages. So they followed these kids. They did it, I think, 2 schools where they followed them from grade school to high school. And all of the kids did exponentially better than the students who were in other grade levels. And it's the same thing in Curaçao. You have a school that's completely in Papiamentu. And even though there are some issues in terms of like funding and things like that, some of the kids in those schools tend to do better than some of the kids who are considered in the more prestigious Dutch schools. So that sort of says something about like how education is. And I am happy to say that there are people who are pushing for these models to be sort of mainstream and to sort of take into account that, you know, language is a very important part of how our kids internalize their education.
And we've said it a couple of times, actually almost every episode, honestly, on this show about how important language is in the educational system in ways that maybe some people haven't been thinking about before.
Right.
And so I figured it would happen, but I am really appreciative that you're bringing these issues up, because again, it's just another way that language is so, so important, and hopefully another way that people will start thinking about it and how it affects other people, their family, themselves.
Exactly.
I read that you had taught at, was it CUNY?
Yeah.
You taught, yeah. And you were teaching students from the islands, right?
Yeah. So not specifically from Aruba and Curaçao, but I did have a couple of students who were from other Caribbean islands. So Jamaica, Haiti, Trinidad. Yeah.
And is this in large part where you started to hear many of these stories about the educational systems, at least some stories of the educational systems in the islands?
Yeah. I've heard of some beforehand, specifically with Aruba and Curaçao. And where I grew up in Queens, you know, there were some kids who came straight from like Jamaica and Haiti who would talk about their educational system. But that was, I remember when I was teaching, because I taught a course on Caribbean anthropology. And that was the first time that, you know, I really did hear a lot of students, you know, older and younger students, just talk about sort of their experience with language in education in particular. Because for me, because, you know, I'm a linguistic anthropologist, so one of my lessons always fell on Caribbean languages, because I was like, you guys are going to learn about this. And I would say that that class was always the most resistance that I got, especially at the beginning. You know, by the end of the lesson, there were some students that were just like, whoa, you blew my mind. And then there were others who were just like, listen, I grew up speaking Jamaican Patois and it's bad English. That's it. You can't change my mind no matter what I say, you know. So, but, you know, it's a lot. It has a lot to do with just sort of longstanding ideologies and ideas about what language is and what's been sort of ingrained to them. You know, we also have to remember that especially a certain generation and before, they were taught very much in a colonialist system, you know, and that's the thing that I think a lot of people tend to forget when it comes about the Caribbean, you know, that most Caribbean islands are still, first of all, under colonial rule, not just Puerto Rico and not just Aruba and Curaçao, but most of the Caribbean islands, you know, they're under Dutch, French, English, whatever rule, and those educational systems still persist. What a lot of those systems are is that they, and even the ones who are not under rule, you know, not under colonial rule like Jamaica or Trinidad, a lot of them still carry over those still, you know, European systems. So these kids are being taught as if they're growing up in Europe or growing up in the United States, even though that's not their existence at all. And it's not just language, but it's the way that they're taught about different things. Like my parents, for example, they were like, listen, we learned more about snow and the Swiss Alps and all of that than I ever learned about my Caribbean island neighbors. Like they knew nothing about other Caribbean island nations because they were taught about Europe, you know, and thankfully that's, I don't even know if that's necessarily the case anymore. I think, you know, there is a shift, obviously, thank God, but there's still sort of this very European model and a lot of, and I'm assuming American for like places like Puerto Rico and St. Thomas, where it's just like how those kids are taught there is how the kids are going to be taught in the Caribbean. And then they get compared to them. So I know in Aruba and Curaçao, for example, when there was a huge issue that the kids in Aruba and Curaçao were not prepared to go to university in the Netherlands. And the main thing was that they were being compared to Dutch kids in the Netherlands. So they were like, well, look at all these Dutch kids. They're doing so well. I don't understand why these kids on the island are not doing well. And it's like, well, yeah, first and foremost, those kids in the Netherlands are being taught in the language that they grew up in. They're being taught in a Dutch educational model. Whereas the kids in Aruba and Curaçao don't technically need a Dutch educational model. You know, that doesn't work for them because it's a completely different country in essence. You know, so it's something that I think needs to change. And, you know, there are people who are pushing and trying to work on a different educational model that centers Caribbean education, in particular Aruban and Curaçao Island education. But it's a long fight. I think there's a lot of people who still have, you know, what's considered the colonial mentality that, like, whatever the Netherlands is, whatever British is, like, that's what's golden. That's what's going to get us far. And we are nothing compared to that.
Yeah, the colonization thing, I think it was so strong and so well done, like, that it's like affected all of us still, like, no matter how hard we try, it's still there.
Yeah, it's very much. And I like to, and I don't know, like, if I should say this, but because I get so much pushback from people when I say this, but I'm just like, I like to say that colonization succeeded in their plans in the Caribbean, because we are so, like, Europe is the model to progress forward in everything in terms of, like, especially in education, that it sort of really just doesn't work well. Doesn't work well on the islands themselves, you know, and that's something for me personally that I think needs to change, but it's a very much still very prevalent idea that that is what's going to get them far. It's like, oh, well, if we're taught in Dutch, but if not only we're taught in Dutch, if we have this Dutch educational model that not even the Dutch uses anymore, because the type of model that they're using here is actually an older model.
Of course.
From the Dutch, right? That not even the Netherlands uses, but still we're just like holding on strong to it. So it's just, it's a very interesting thing. And I don't know.
Do you have an idea of, I know it's a really big, hard question, but do you have any idea of, like, what the education system should look like, or, like, even just a beginning of where to start?
I think first and foremost, in terms of the language aspect, I think it should involve most of their linguistic repertoire. Like, they do get Spanish and French, I believe, as language classes. And English as well, but, you know, I'm really sort of partial to the multilingual model, and that's just my personal belief, or the bilingual model that they're having in Curaçao, where one school is doing Papiamento in English. But I also think education-wise, just centering the Caribbean in their education, in terms of, like, the history of the Caribbean, specifically what happened on the islands and what happened on the other islands, and how does that work for us in terms of sort of not only just politically, but economically as well. Because, I mean, a lot of these kids, for the most part, on the islands, most kids end up in the tourism sector or end up in, like, a business sector where they have to do dealings with South America, or they have to do dealings with, you know, even with Europe. I think in a way, if we center the Caribbean within our education, we can, and this is not just for Aruba and Curaçao, I think other Caribbean islands, if we sort of work together and figured something out, I think it would really work in a way that most students would sort of get the best out of their education, but also would prepare them for a life in the Caribbean, as opposed to preparing them for a life in the Netherlands, which, you know, there are some students who stay there, but there are increasingly a lot of students who are coming back. And they're having a hard time, for example, finding jobs, or a hard time reacclimating back to the Caribbean islands. So I think that's one of the things, you know, for me, first and foremost, because I work with language, I really think that doing something in terms of the language, not solely Dutch, but I personally think, like, a multilingual, a bilingual approach might work best.
Yeah, and you say that, and it seems so simple and obvious to me, but I know it's like, politics are going to make everything much more much more colonized. I mean, whoops. What? Much more complicated. So then, would it be accurate to say that colonization, or the colonized mindset, is one of the major drivers behind a lot of people feeling and thinking that Creoles are bad?
Yes, but I'll take it a bit further and say that it's not just colonization, it's more than that. So, like I said, during colonization on the Dutch Caribbean islands in particular, the Dutch didn't want anything to do with, like, teaching the Dutch language. So you actually had the Spanish missionaries who would teach the indigenous people on the islands, as well as the enslaved Africans, through Papiamento, because their ideas at the time, these Catholic missionaries or these Catholic priests, were like, well, in order to save the soul of these quote-unquote heathens, we have to teach them in their own language. So they were being taught in Papiamento actually before they were being taught in Dutch.
Interesting.
What was interesting is, I think this was like the late 1800s or so. You have this guy from the Netherlands who comes to the colonies, in particular to Curaçao, to assess what like life is like on the islands. And what he notices is that a lot of the white Dutch descendant children are speaking Papiamentu. They're not speaking Dutch. And that their moms are also speaking Papiamentu. So basically the only people who are speaking Dutch are these white men who are talking to each other because of trade and, you know, their business. And the reason why these children and these mothers are speaking Papiamentu is because their yayas, which yayas were the maids, the women who would take care of these kids, you know, they spoke Papiamentu with these kids. You know, they're raising these kids, basically, and they're speaking Papiamentu. And he goes back to the Netherlands, and he has this huge report about how these poor white Dutch children are being bastardized into like this language and this culture, and how they need to learn their Dutch culture and their Dutch history and their Dutch language. So it's something that like they unintentionally shifted all of the education into Dutch so these white Dutch children can learn Dutch. But then it turned into like the enslaved Africans and the indigenous people also supposedly learning through Dutch. But the problem is that at that time, still people weren't really being taught in Dutch. It was still like heavily Papiamentu. And it wasn't, from what I've read, it wasn't until I think like the 1920s, 1930s, when the oil refineries come to the island, that you start to really see that shift of like, okay, we need to be teaching in Dutch because we're having all these people who are coming in onto our islands to come work at these refineries, especially in Curaçao, where it was a lot of Dutch people coming in. And they're like, we have to have one language for them to be taught in. So that's where you start to see that shift of like really, really Dutch being in education. Like it was there before, but like being very strict Dutch, I want to say is probably the early 1900s. And from then on until, I don't know, maybe the 1980s, 1990s. Is when we start to see some people like, okay, we should start thinking about Papiamentu. You see it a little bit in the 1960s because the 1960s, there's sort of like this, there's a lot of things happening in the 1960s in terms of like independence in a lot of countries and a shifting into autonomous status in 1954. And, you know, you have a lot of people who from the islands, they went to the Netherlands and came back and were like, well, we are not Dutch, we are this. And like, let's push our Papiamentu, let's push our culture. But it's not until, let's say, the 1980s, 1990s that you really start to see that shift of like, okay, how are we going to put Papiamentu in education? What are we going to do to get there? So it's sort of like, I guess to make a long story short, like colonization is a part of it, but it really sort of happens when an economic force that came in became sort of the driving idea of like, we really need Dutch as like the language of education.
Right. So. I mean, I feel like that's kind of the whole point of colonization is this economic driver. So it's not surprising that that's what ultimately sort of tipped it over.
Right. Right.
I guess one final question is, why do Creole languages matter?
Ooh, that's a good question. And that's something that I've been trying to justify in all of my grant applications and dissertation proposal. Yeah. Why care about them? It's funny because my advisor, Paul Garrett, he had a whole article dedicated to why should we care about these languages? And I am going to say that because it's a language that people speak, I mean, you know, we have less than 300,000 speakers in the whole wide world who speak this language, and it's come so far. You know, why should it have any less value than English or Spanish or French just because it's a newer language and just because it has less than 300,000 speakers, you know? I mean, people have gone far with that language, whether people on these islands think they have or not, but you know, through their language, they've been able to do so many things. And I think that it shouldn't have any less value no matter if you can go far with it or not, like, yeah, nobody outside of these islands will speak it. So if I go to New York, I'm not going to be able to speak it with people there, obviously. But at the same time, if I learn to speak other languages through that language, you know, if I learn to comprehend things through that language, if I learn to analyze stuff through that language, it would open up a whole world to me, you know. And for me, someone who wasn't born on the island, on either islands, I came here as a kid in the summers. But at the same time, because my mother and my father, they instilled Papiamentu and English into me, there were so many things that I could do with Papiamentu that I couldn't do with English, or there were so many things that I could comprehend through Papiamentu that I couldn't with English, and vice versa. So it's opened up a world to me in ways that I feel, you know, monolingual speakers, for example, or speakers of just one European language, they don't have. And even with languages in general, like my comprehension of Spanish and even Portuguese is a lot better because of Papiamentu, you know? Like, Papiamentu has a lot of Spanish and Portuguese in it, and I won't say that I'm fluent in either languages, but I still understand so much more in those languages. And yeah, when I'm, like, for example, I was in Costa Rica, I was in Colombia last year, I noticed that my Spanish was a lot better because I was in Curaçao for the previous couple of months, as opposed to when I come from, like, New York. And, well, not New York, because New York has also a lot of Spanish speakers, but, like, you know, like, if I was in an environment that didn't have a lot of Spanish speakers, and me going to these countries and trying to speak Spanish, which I know a little bit of Spanish, it was still a lot harder for me to sort of comprehend, as opposed to, like, me coming from a place where I'm constantly hearing Papiamentu, and then I go to these other countries, and I'm just like, oh, yeah, Spanish is sort of working for me. There are moments, yes, where I'll slip and use a Papiamentu word instead of Spanish, but it was still a way for me to comprehend. And I think that's what gets lost in sort of this debate about whether Papiamentu could take you far or not. Like, yes, no other place in the world speaks this language, which works out great if we want to talk shit about people, you know? At the same time, you know, just learning things through your own language and being able to comprehend things through your own language and learning other languages through your own language, it just opens up a whole world that, you know, you might not otherwise have access to.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Yeah, it was
thank
really
you.
Fun.
I hope I didn't talk too long. I tend to
No, it's perfect. Yeah.
I tend to like get into story mode, and I'm like, wait, we have to discuss this. So
no, it's
well, that's
perfect.
What we want. We want
stories. Yeah, exactly. We want stories. We don't want it like to, you know, for me and Carrie just to be like preaching and, or like lecturing.
Right.
Stories is perfect.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much. And we always leave our listeners with our final or our message of don't be an asshole.
Don't be an asshole.
Nice.
Can you say that in Papiamentu?
Oh yeah. How would you say
don't
that?
Don't be an asshole. Okay, hold on. Let me say. You know, so you would say something along the lines of like, no biro un muchiconho. You know, so don't be like a kid asshole or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I love it.
I'm kind of hearing like some Spanish influence in there for sure.
Yeah, I'm sorry. No, muchiconho, which means mucha diconho. So don't be like a mother's asshole. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, don't be the child of an asshole or something like that.
So, I love it.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Cursing in Papiamentu is just so much fun. So much fun.
Yeah.
Honestly, if we had time, I could do a whole podcast on, like, cursing in Papiamentu.
Maybe we should do that in the future.
Yes. You'll come. We'll have you back in, like, a year. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Tidrek Blaze.
The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by me, Carrie Gillen, for Halftone Audio. Theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Vocal Fries Pod. You can email us at vocalfriespod@gmail.com, and our website is vocalfriespod.com.